Hello and welcome to Guess That Record. I am your host, Jackson Reed. This is the show where we talk about music and try to figure out which album I pulled from my collection. This episode of Guess That Record originally released on October 26th, 2022. The episode features the Hot City Horns, a horn section based out of London, England, featuring Paul Burton on trombone, Mike Davis on trumpet, and Kenji Fenton on saxophone. Since 2018, they've been touring with Paul McCartney, appearing with him in stadiums all over the world. They've also performed with artists such as Ollie Murs, Jess Glynn, and Emily Sandy. With all that being said, let's get into the interview. How are you guys doing today?
Hey, Jackson.
Hey, man.
Hey, man. How you doing? You all right?
I'm doing good. Yeah. Yeah. It's super cool to be speaking with you guys today. You're the first guests that we've had on the show that aren't in North America. So that's pretty cool. And it's kind of hitting me because it's like 9 a.m. for me right now. So I had to get up nice and early for this recording, but I'm happy to do it to talk with you guys. Now, just to make sure the listeners sort of know how your voices sound, why don't you say your name and then what instrument you play?
Right. Well, I'm Paul. I play the trombone.
I'm Mike and I play trumpet.
And I'm Kenji and I play the saxophone.
Awesome.
Kenji's waving as well, which I think is funny.
I realize it's a podcast, but you man can see in it. So.
We do have the video, so it's all good to wave. Yeah. So now you guys are you guys all in London right now?
Yes.
Here we are, yeah.
London or thereabouts on the outskirts.
Right, right. And that's awesome because like London is probably top of the list of places I would like to visit that I haven't yet. British music has had a huge influence on me, so I would love to go there one day for sure.
Yeah, I know that we had to send in some artists that we're into and that sort of thing, so you know about us, but we have no idea what are you into?
Well, I mean, I like pretty much anything from the 60s to the 80s. I mean, my shirt kind of gives that away a little bit there.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Now, are you guys all originally from London or are you from different areas in England?
Kenji's sort of.
I guess I'm the closest. I'm from a little town just outside of London called Stevenage, which is just north of London. But Mike and Paul are actually from the other end of the country. Tell them, boys.
Yeah, from the dark side. We're north of the border, I don't know, 200 miles away, maybe.
I'm from Hull. Mike, where are you from, Mike, originally?
I'm from Yorkshire, but I guess Manchester is the nearest place. So,
Jackson, have you seen Game of Thrones?
I watched maybe 20 minutes of the first episode and then got bored. So,
well, where for the listeners, for anyone who's seen them, anyone who's living on the wall or in the north, that's basically how everyone speaks where we're from, where me and Mike are from.
Right.
We've just had to adapt our accents moving down to London. Right. So like,
yeah. Now, so it sounds like you guys all started on horns then as like your first instruments.
Started on piano. And then when I was 5, when I was 8, I started the trombone.
I didn't start horn first. I played a bit of ukulele when I was younger and then moved onto trumpet.
I was full horns. Well, I don't know if you can call the recorder a horn, but that was my first love.
Awesome. let's get into the timeline of the Hot City Horns. So, how did you guys meet and sort of get started with all this?
Well, so me and Mike met at university. So we studied at the Liverpool Institute for Performing Arts, which is in Liverpool, which was set up by Paul McCartney as a kind of performing arts school. So that's quite a nice little link to what we've ended up doing more recently. So that was up in Liverpool. Me and Mike were in class together. There wasn't a lot of horn players in our year. So we would naturally just sort of start playing together quite a lot. Kenji was not far away in the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester. And so as we were like going through university, we would we would bump into Kenji, wouldn't we? We'd see him on the odd gig. We'd know of each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
yeah.
then we all moved down to London at various points. And I think we maybe, it's fair to say, we saw sort of like a gap for doing something as a collective, as a horn section. You know, there's a lot of great horn players and brass players in London, but there's not as many doing it as a unit, a three-piece unit. And I think that was probably the reason that we formed a group, if you like.
Definitely. Yeah, I was also going to say that when I first moved down to London, I did a little bit of moonlighting with some other, you know, in sort of pickup groups, if you will. That and it's definitely it's much, not only socially is it better, but musically it's much better to work with two people that you work with all the time and that have the same goals. I found that a lot of other horn players that I play with kind of wanted to play in the section, but were kind of more about being individuals. And I think that a section needs people to be committed to the blend. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a great lead vocalist doesn't always make a good backing singer. Do you know what I mean? And vice versa.
Exactly. Yeah. And how did you guys come up with the name?
I can't even remember that.
I was on a run this morning. I was like, I bet he asked us how we came up with the name, so I should have an answer ready. But it's one of those very nothing stories, I think, where we just kind of, I remember me and Mike bouncing some ideas around, you know, and we just sort of settled on it. And I can't really remember.
I remember being on a tour bus and somebody in the band that we were away on tour with penciled out on the back of a loose piece of paper, a load of random names. And some of them were really awful, but I can't remember. It was literally a sort of almost like a lucky dip. Do you prefer that one? Do you prefer that? It was just one of those on that list.
Yeah, and I don't know, Jackson, if you play anything or if you've ever been in a band, but coming up with a band name or a group name is like the most hardest and horrible thing ever. You know, like, you think of names of any band that you've heard of, you know, like the Beatles or the Foo Fighters or the Arctic Monkeys, and you just like, if you just say those words, it could sound like nothing, but all of a sudden they become these massive world-known bands.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's basically how we settled on that. And it was more to give us an identity, I guess, you know, like this idea of a product, I guess, or something that is more than just three guys, make it one. And to do that, we needed a name, you know.
Yeah. No, I am a musician myself, and I've got my own group. And, yeah, it's for me, it was more just finding a name that hadn't been taken. So just Googling, has this name been used? Okay, that one has. So on to the next one until we got something. So yeah.
So, I mean, it's hard. What's your band called then?
It's Jackson Reed and the Silverbirds.
Oh, nice.
Okay, nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So yeah, it's, nice. I wanted a bird because I thought like that's pretty like rock and roll. But it was just going through every type of bird until Silverbirds seemed pretty open. So now you guys have obviously been able to land some incredible opportunities. But I have to imagine it was a pretty long grind to sort of work your way up the ladder.
Yeah. I mean, like a lot of things, you have to work hard and keep working at it. Maybe have a little lucky meeting, you know, you meet someone along the way and so on. You know, we've definitely worked hard though, but had to pay our bills.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of that is the reason that we came together as well. Like we paid more dues separately than we did when we were like, right, okay, right, well, we've done all this stuff. This isn't necessarily what we want to do. We want to do that. How's the best way of doing that? Let's get together. Let's make it a thing. And let's, you know, form an action plan and attack, if you will. Do you not think, boys?
I think so.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Also, a lot of people ask us, like, do we get our work through an agent and things like that? Very much, I'm sure globally for a horn player, it's very much sort of reputation and word of mouth, a lot of these things, which can go negatively as well if you bait your ass. You know what I mean? Yeah, I think that's fair to say that, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
definitely. It's like a combination. I think we always saw it as a combination of, you know, play well, move well, look good, key things to kind of turn up on time, do a good job, put the effort in, you know. I think we tried to give the same amount of effort to whatever it was we were doing so that we're always doing a good job, not just for the people that were doing it, but for ourselves, I think, as well. We set like that high standard of what we expected from ourselves, and, you know, we still do to this day. And I personally think that's a big reason why we've gone on to do some of the things that we've maybe done.
Absolutely, yeah. Consistency is key. Definitely.
Yeah. What, I guess, like, even, you know, like, by yourselves or, like, together, what was, like, the first gig where you remember kind of going, like, I think we may be onto something here?
Let's say the first gig we ever did together. That sounds like the right answer.
Yeah.
Can you remember the first gig we... Well, it depends whether we're thinking about the first gig we did with Ollie Mers, which was at Sheffield Arena. I remember that quite well. But also we did... but we also...
Are you sure you want to talk about
this? No, but we also we did a gig together for a fashion show.
Yeah.
The first time that we went, this is good. We all enjoy, you know.
You could talk about that, okay.
Well, yeah, so I had a friend who needed a horn section. And I think basically these guys had worked together for quite a few years because they were in the same place. But I kind of wasn't in it yet, and I wanted to be in it. I wanted to be in it. And so my way of getting in it was to book, I'd sort of moved down to London and I had this gig that was paying decent money and it's for the L Fashion Awards and they were even buying us suits and stuff. So I was like, right, this is my chance to impress these boys, right? So I was like, I booked the horn section with me in it, thinking, well, what will happen is we'll have a fantastic time and hopefully after this, then they won't ask me to leave. And that's what went down.
Now, Paul McCartney.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's it. That's the end of the podcast. Right there, Paul McCartney. you guys got the opportunity of a lifetime when you joined up with him in 2018. And I've found, like, in my experience, moving up in the music industry is just all about knowing the right people. Like, you know someone who knows someone, and then it just goes from there. Was that how you got the job with Paul?
I think essentially, yeah. Me and Mike did a charity show which happened at the Royal Albert Hall back in, I think, like 2014, maybe 2015.
So we
went and did that, and we met the MD for that show was Paul Wicks Wickens, who's Paul McCartney's keyboard player, and so we met him at that occasion. But it was a huge event with a whole orchestra as well, and then. Didn't really, you know, have much to, you know, didn't speak to Paul much after that. But then, yeah, 2018, around May 2018, we hear from him saying, need to talk to you about something. So I think that's where the initial meetup came. But then I think there was also this connection with Lipo, where me and Mike had studied, which was the school that Paul McCartney had set up, which was another thing that he could speak to Paul about and be like, well, I know these guys, and then it sort of went from there, and, you know, some meetings and what have you after that, and before we know it, we're flying out to New York for rehearsals, and then to Canada.
Mm.
That was the first place we gigged with him.
Right.
Yeah.
And I have to imagine that the first time you meet Paul, it's got to be a bit freaky, just because he's like, it's Paul McCartney, you know? Do you remember, like, the first meeting or the first rehearsal with him?
Well, Paul's and myself's first encounter of him was actually receiving our degrees. And mine didn't go quite as planned as I thought, because in a fluster for the photograph where you're supposed to be posing and giving the scroll and stuff, I ended up pulling his finger. Yeah, it's as weird as it sounds. So that was my first encounter. But yeah, I think when we got out there to New York, first professional encounter, he was just as relaxed as anybody, really, as a person. It was us three that were like, behave yourself and don't, you know, stay in lane.
But it's like when you join any kind of new, you know, if you enter any other musical world, it's always nerve-wracking, especially one that a lot of the people involved with Paul McCartney have been working with him for so long, and you're stepping into that world. It's a bit terrifying, really, because you're very much the new guys who no one, you know, a lot of people didn't know a lot about. So, you know, you have to, like Mike says, be on your best behavior.
Yeah, and we'd heard a lot about how long, all we'd sort of heard was about how long everyone else had been there before we met up with them, and how long everyone had done it from. And that goes throughout the whole camp. Like, it's really is a touring family, and lots of people have been there for years, and, you know, people's children are even starting to work for the camp. It's really is a family environment, and so to have three new guys come into that was, I feel like, was a bit strange for them. And then obviously for us, when you get to, when you're about to go and play for Paul McCartney, and also at that point you can't tell anyone that you're going to play for Paul McCartney, you can't even tell your family where you're going. It was all a little bit CIA, all a little bit there. Do you know what I mean? Which was new, because you know all the other gigs I'd done before, I could tell people. So it was a bit different, wasn't it, boys?
A little bit, yeah.
And then unfortunately, on the flight over to New York, I managed to get some sort of illness, And so I was terrified I was going to make everybody sick as well, which is not a good look. So I was trying not to cough and splutter over everybody.
Nice, yeah. For me, like the Beatles were like my beginning in music. Like when I was a kid and I heard Paperback Writer, I was like, nothing was the same after that. Were you guys Beatle fans when you were growing up as well?
I don't think actually any of us were, which is...
Oh,
not a fan though. I mean, my dad was a huge fan. You know, I think he has every single Beatles album on the original vinyl. So I did grow up, you know, hearing about them from my dad, and it was probably the first time he took me seriously as a musician when I told him I was going to work with Paul McCartney. I was going to say, what I think is quite interesting about the three of us is our like musical upbringing, if you like, was very varied and completely different, and what we were all into musically was individually is completely different. I don't think we really share the same thing. You know, I was a big rock fan, you know, so I'm Foo Fighters, that's Foo Fighters, Oasis, that's what I was listening to when I was younger, and I don't think these two were.
No, not so much. But everyone grows up aware of the Beatles, but also, and everyone grows up aware of Lennon and McCartney as songwriters. I think I very much was much more aware of that than I was of their versions of songs. So like when I was my parents were big Motown fans, like Stax, Atlantic, you know, I know Aretha singing some of Paul's songs. I know Gladys Knight singing some of Paul's songs. And, you know, I know them that way. But also when I was younger, I used to play in wind orchestras and orchestras. And I know that, you know, in the wind orchestras and those sorts of things, I'd look at the top of the page and the songwriter would be whatever the arrangement we were playing was, the composer was Lennon and McCartney. Everyone's aware of the Beatles and everyone's aware of that music. And even if you're not brought up on it, as a musician, you always come across their songwriting in various guises, in any ensemble that you play in. You're going to play some Lennon and McCartney. It's going to happen. It's just going to happen. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Yeah. And you guys had mentioned that the first show you played with him was in New York, which was, of course, the Grand Central Station show. Mm. And just what a amazing place to have your first show with him. How did that one go?
It was wild because that we hadn't, while we've played for quite a lot of different people, you realize what real celebrity is when you play for someone like Paul, because you know the center of New York City pretty much shut down, and not just because of him, because it was a concert for him and for guests. So everybody, I think there were 200 people that were coming to see it, and they were all guests of his. And I don't think it was until the show started that I thought what that would mean. I don't know about you boys. Did you, like, we were so busy trying to panicking about what we were going to play. I don't think we thought about what that means. And we start the show in the middle of the audience. So we start off stage. And so, you know, the show started and we're sort of backstage all trying to pretend we're not nervous and, you know, trying to talk each other through what's about to happen and what have you. And then they take us out into the crowd to you know, start off stage. And there wasn't enough room for us. So I can remember on my side, I'm looking to my right and I'm like there's not enough room. And I've got to tell the person next to me to move. And it was Meryl Streep and John Bon Jovi. And I was just like, this is different. This world is different. Do you know what I mean? This is.
Yeah, I remember after we played our show, that song, and we go backstage, I remember quite, as I was sweaty, because I've been sweating and I'm probably panicking a little bit, sort of in my quite clumsy way, which is quite normal for me, I push someone out the way, and one of these two, when I get back, they're like, you know, you just pushed Kate Moss out the way.
And so, yeah, it was a really, really wild experience. And then also, you know, the way as we walk out of the gig, there are line, you know, people are, crowds are lined up just screaming at Paul. And I'd seen that on the television, but to be in it, not in it, they're not screaming at me, obviously, but to be, to experience that firsthand was wild. It really was wild. Really was.
Yeah, no, he's probably the most famous living musician. I think you can make a case for that. So it's got to be eye-opening for sure. And then you guys went on the Freshen Up tour, which was from like the fall of 2018 to the summer of 2019. And you guys played four continents during that run. Was that the first time you guys had really been all over the world like that?
I think to that degree, definitely.
Yeah.
We'd visited little bits, you know, we'd sort of been over to the States here and there, but not, I'd personally never been to Canada before. And we start off in, what was it, Quebec, Edmonton,
Montreal,
Winnipeg.
I don't think any of us had ever. I know we'd been to Japan very briefly with Jess Glynn, but very much in and out. Whereas we went for a couple of weeks, and that I think we all enjoyed that a lot. And
I'd never done a tour where I need different types of wardrobe. That's how I knew things were different. Like, I've always done something, and you go to a certain part, and you know the climate is going to be fairly similar.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But all of a sudden, I had like shorts, but also had a winter jacket all in the same bag. I was like, okay. This is rockstar behavior.
So what I know exactly what you're talking about is when we first go over to rehearsals with Paul in New York, and then we go to Canada. I don't think any of us really thought what going to Edmonton and Winnipeg in late September really means. Well, I know we didn't, because none of us at all had enough clothing. I'll never forget.
It was very much, it was Edmonton that really, really took it. Though,
Winnipeg's got those underground things, you know, underground like walkways, but. Yeah, and when we got to Edmonton, I just remember, the temperature had changed, and we went to go to go have some food and drinks, and I think none of us will ever forget the walk from the hotel to the bar in like just a jumper, you know, no coat or anything. But then straight after that, we go straight down to Austin for the Austin City Limits Festival, baking hot. So it was it's very confusing.
Yeah. I'd never. That's how I knew I hadn't been very far. Do you know what I mean? Because that was a new problem.
Well, the good thing, I mean, even though Calgary and Edmonton are pretty close together, very different climates, because Calgary is usually a bit warmer.
Okay.
Edmonton is like a frozen wasteland most of the year. So,
so cold.
Yeah.
So cold.
Yeah. Now, when you guys started, you know, going all over the place with Paul, have you noticed, and I guess with your other gigs that you've had, have you noticed differences between audiences in different countries?
Oh yeah. Well, you go, Mike.
I was gonna say, some of the loudest audience we've ever seen was down in South America. Absolute craziness in a great way. And then the other extreme is equally as enjoyable from an audience perspective, but from a culture point of view, just a lot quieter and sort of polite and whatever. Japan was really, really strange, because you've got fireworks going off and Live and Let Die and, you know, massive loud PA systems and stuff like that, and then you'll just get, and then before the next song, silence.
Absolute silence, yeah. They listen to it, which to me makes a lot of sense. Like, around the rest of the world, why are we going to a show and screaming all over it? It makes no sense. Like, I want to hear what I paid for. Like, the, you know,
that's kind of how I watch shows. I'm pretty reserved during a concert. Yeah,
but even across like America and Canada, North America, like, because it's obviously such that we're talking about big countries, you'll notice differences there. Like New Orleans always stands out as like, it was like everyone was having an absolute ball. You know, it was like so loud, and then. Then you'll go to some of the bigger cities in America, and it's maybe a bit more reserved, which that's the classic thing in England. Like a London crowd is generally a bit more reserved than a North of England crowd. And, you know, and then you'd go, and then with Paul, we'll play some really sort of smaller town places. And, they maybe don't get artists like that coming to their town. They'll go absolutely wild, you know. So it's fascinating from that point of view, just to see the difference.
And they go wild all day, and I think it's fairly similar, like in England, and I think what we're saying is places in the world, big cities in the world that have multiple things going on all at the same time, while they're appreciative, that it's a little bit more, as an audience member, you sort of go to that gig, and sort of stand there with an attitude of, well, okay, I've made, you're my choice for the evening, entertain me. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Whereas I think when in smaller towns where maybe they don't have as many concerts and they don't have as many things, they come with a more supportive attitude, if you will, and that it's you know, this might be the only time that something like this happens this year, so it's going to be the best night of my life. And you can feel that energy. I mean, when we went to some of the smaller places, like, was it the Green Bay? But what was the place that we went to?
Green Bay was like, the day before they had Beatles tribute bands.
Yeah. Yeah, just it was like a band. Carnival atmosphere, or like for days around it.
Yeah.
And that felt really special, especially as we were sort of walking through it, thinking, this is all here for us, but nobody knows. This is great.
Now, when did you guys find out that Paul was going to go on tour again? Because of course he just completed the Got Back tour. When did you guys know that was going to happen?
Shortly after that, when obviously the Got Back tour sort of came into our diaries, if you will. Yeah, but to see him just sort of get back, essentially, you know, get into it and see people's reactions to it, that was quite special. This last few, and also we've all had a reset, and don't get really, you know, complacent or blasé about it anymore. So it kind of meant a lot more than what it had have done, you know, had you been away constantly.
Well, when you're traveling quite a lot, like, yeah, it is easy to get complacent. But I know personally, when we did this last tour, I very much made the most of everywhere I went, and you know, taking the people, you know, the each place where I was and just make the most of it. I really appreciate traveling again, you know.
Mm. And I think that was also, though, I feel like there's a different energy with audiences as well. Like, don't get me wrong, a McCartney show is always special. Do you know what I mean? But I feel like concerts of that size, even if you didn't think music was finished, the idea at one point of getting that amount of people together without a mask sitting next to each other was not comprehensible. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so for that to start happening, and yeah, I feel like everybody that was on stage, everybody behind the scenes, you know, crew, lorry, you know, people that drive the lorries, people that do catering, all of those people had their livelihoods taken away from them. And so when that came back, they felt really special. But also audiences thought they would never get to see a gig on that scale again. And so everybody in the room was having a moment, I think. And I think that, I hope that continues, actually, because it really does feel special at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, don't get us wrong, there was masses of COVID protocol and sort of, you know, safeguarding and stuff before that, from a crew point of view. But yeah, it was, felt normal again.
Mm. The new normal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm proud to say I attended.
Come on.
Hey.
Where did you see it?
I went to the very first show in Spokane.
Amazing.
And that was my first ever Paul McCartney show. And it was, you know, because I remember when you guys played in Edmonton, mm-hmm. and we thought about going, but like, it just wasn't, like, the scheduling wasn't great. And I was like,
too cold, wasn't it? Too cold.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to drive to Edmonton. But I ended up kind of, especially, you know, the winter before the tour, the Get Back documentary came out, and I was like on the Beatles train once again, you know, like I was just listening to everything, and I was like, man, I should have gone to that show. Like, I haven't seen Paul yet, and I'll kick myself if I don't see him. And then when I saw that he's coming back on tour, and the first show was in Spokane, you know, it's not too far from Calgary. So we went, and I'm so glad I did, because it was like the best show I've ever seen. Aww. It was weird though, because I was like, what's he doing in Spokane? Like, that's such a weird place to go for Paul. But yeah, it was a great time.
Mm.
This is what I love about, you know, what Paul in particular, when he tours. Yeah, he'll go wherever. Well, he can go anywhere because he's obviously known everywhere, you know. But yeah, you'll play the SoFi Stadium in LA, but he'll also play an arena in Spokane, which I'd definitely never heard of Spokane before we went there.
Yeah.
I think he makes a conscious effort to try and go to places he hasn't been before, or go to, you know what I mean? As long as there's a venue nearby that's sort of big enough, he wants to do new things. And I think that you can see that through his art history, that's just the sort of man that he is. Do you know what I mean? He's forever trying to push boundaries and do new things, which is great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Spokane was beautiful as well. I don't know if you'd ever been
to Fall
Jackson. Yeah. Oh, can you remember those falls as well?
The waterfall, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the whiskey bar.
Oh, yeah, the whiskey bar, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think, though, that was a great show to go to because of the fact it was the first one on the tour. So, you know, like, yeah, you guys hadn't played live in like 3 years. Mm. So it was a big moment in that regard. And I think it was also good because of the fact it was a bit of a smaller arena. You know, like you were saying, you know, you've played like SoFi Stadium, which is like, you know, 50,000 people. And then Spokane was like 10,000. So it was a bit more intimate in that regard, I think. And also the fact that we didn't know that the bit where he sings with John Lennon on I've Got a Feeling, I didn't know that was coming. And no one knew that was coming. And then, of course, it got spoiled on social media for everyone else. So that was kind of cool, too.
You were genuinely there the first time that happened, right?
Yeah,
I know. Yeah, and it was so good. It's just a better memory of Spokane for me as well, because before that, the most noteworthy thing that had happened to me in Spokane was when I was a kid and I had my bike stolen there.
Oh. So, not cool. Not cool.
Yeah, the concert. Concert's a much better time. I have to ask about this because at the end of the tour, you guys played MetLife Stadium in East Rutherford, New Jersey, home of the Jets and the Giants in the NFL. And you guys played with Bruce Springsteen. He came out and played a few songs with Paul, which is I'm so jealous because he might be my favorite artist of all time. Like he's why I sing my own songs, basically.
Right.
What was it like to play with him?
It was amazing, but I feel like one thing that I should mention is that none of the three of us were aware that everybody, when Bruce comes on stage, goes,
Bruce,
which we thought was everybody booing, and we were really confused because everyone had told us he's from New Jersey. This, you know, this is almost like a hometown show for him when he's going to come out. We were very confused.
Very confused. Mm-hmm. Very, very confused.
Yeah. I feel like it's funny because like that's been happening like his whole career, and they're, yeah, I mean, there are still people that think like, are they booing him?
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But no, it was amazing. Yeah, you know, cool. another musical icon, you know, two icons together on stage. It's, yeah. And seeing the crowd's reaction, you know, amazing.
Also, though, for me, it was seeing his reaction to Paul.
Yeah.
As well. Like he sat and watched the whole concert from side of stage. And he's genuinely, they're genuinely fans of each other's music. And that was really beautiful. You know, he talked about seeing Paul on the Bruce was speaking to us about seeing the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan show and how, you know, it changed his life. And he came downstairs the next day and combed all his hair forward and decided, you know, I'm going to be a rock star type vibe. So one of the things about playing for someone like Paul is you see other people that you think would be blasé about meeting him still get gassed and still be excited. And that was really nice. And then obviously when Bruce walks up and opens his mouth and sounds exactly the same as the record, it's like, you know, still it's something special.
And I think this can provide some good insight on what these sort of guest appearances are like, because you guys played Bruce's song Glory Days, which of course is not normally in Paul's set list. So when did you find out that he was going to be playing with you guys? And then what was the process for the band to sort of learn the song before the show?
I think we'd got a tip off that something was going to happen at some point of the tour when we were in rehearsals, which was in Los Angeles at the start of April. So we ran that song, obviously, without Bruce, and then sort of kind of forgot about it for the next, two and a half months or something. So when we got to MetLife and realized that was about to happen, everyone's like, oh shit, we better get Glory Days down again. it was kind of that thing. And then obviously ran it a couple of times and everything's still locked in. That was pretty much it, I think.
He came and did Glastonbury with us as well. We had, after at the end of the tour, we headlined Glastonbury, and he came and came out there as well, which was also amazing.
Yeah.
I was actually just going to ask you about that, because, yeah, like a week later, you were playing with him again at Glastonbury. And I remember opening up my Instagram and seeing that, and I was like, they can't keep getting away with it. I also probably was like, I bet you Paul told Bruce, come with us to Glastonbury when you guys were at MetLife. Because it was like, it was quite a coincidence that like a week later they're playing again on the other side of the world. So what was it like to headline Glastonbury? Because that's like such, you know, it's one of the biggest festivals in the world. So that must have been like such a rush to play in front of that many people.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, for me personally, it's I used to watch Glastonbury every year when I was, you know, on the TV over here in England, and would just dream of being involved in a show like that, a headline show. So, for, yeah, me personally, it was absolutely amazing, and to do it with these guys and to do it playing with Paul was definitely, I think, one that we'll never forget. The energy that was coming off that crowd was insane, and you know, it was just wow.
And Dave Grohl was there, of course, as well. Foo Fighters fan, so
don't get me started. I stood at the stage when he did. I saw her standing there, and I was just it was amazing. I was just watching it going, this is unbelievable. I've seen the Foo Fighters loads, so.
All right, well, it's now time for the guessing segment of this podcast, for which it gets its name. I will go over the rules for you guys and any new listeners we might have out there. In this bag that I'm holding right now is a record from my personal collection of albums. I will give you guys three clues about this album, and then you have to ask me up to 15 yes or no questions in order to determine the identity of the album. And don't worry if you need a hint here or there. I'm not here to make you look bad, so I'm happy to point you in the right direction if you should. it's going to be interesting, though, because it's the first time on this show where we have a group working together to guess the record. So you guys have teamwork on your side. Okay. So Paul, Mike, Kenji, are you guys ready to guess that record?
Absolutely.
We'll try.
Yeah, we'll try.
All right. Here are your three clues. This album came out in the 1980s. Seven of its songs were released as singles, with each one of them reaching the top 10 of the Billboard Hot 100. And this album was important in the development of music videos. Question one.
Is the album from a solo artist?
Yes. Question two.
Is the solo artist still alive?
No. Question three.
Can the artist moonwalk?
Yes. Question four.
Well, is the artist Michael Jackson?
The artist is Michael Jackson. Question five.
Is...
Come on, think of some good questions there, Ken.
I'm thinking of some good questions. Leave it with me. Someone else asked.
You guys can do it. You guys can. You can do it.
We can do ask, what?
Ask if you know what the album is.
We can just guess. Guess, well, Mike.
Yeah.
Is one of the tracks Big at Halloween?
Yes, it is. Yep. Question six.
Do it, Mike. Do it.
Is it Thriller?
It's Thriller.
Love that record.
And so yeah, when you guys were when we were getting set up to do this podcast, Paul mentioned to me that you guys liked Michael Jackson, and I thought, well, Thriller is such a great album, and the other great thing about picking this album is that your boss is on this album.
Of course.
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
Paul McCartney. Yeah. He does the Girl Is Mine. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a monster record, so it's a fun one to talk about. And before we move on with the discussion, I'll just give some facts about the album for the rare person that has no idea what we're talking about. Thriller is the sixth studio album by Michael Jackson. It was released on November 30th, 1982, and turned Michael into one of the most famous artists of all time. The album spent 37 non-consecutive weeks at number one. And as I mentioned in the clues, it had seven singles reach the top 10 of the Billboard charts, with Billie Jean and Beat It both hitting number one. The album is currently the best-selling record of all time, with 70 million copies sold worldwide. Holy smokes.
Wow.
The funny thing, though, is that it's actually not the best-selling album in the U.S. That title belongs to the Eagles with their 1971 to 75 Greatest Hits album.
Oh, really?
So, Thriller is the second best-selling album in the U.S. Yeah, it's quite funny how that how that works out. So how did you guys all get into Michael Jackson? Was it just because he usually has a lot of horns on his songs, or?
I think pretty much, yeah. You hear tracks as you're growing up on the radio and stuff like that. If it's got horns in, then you'll immediately listen to it.
And then once you start finding out who did the horns on that album, you know, that leads us to Jerry Hay, who's a big influence, I think, for the three of us and us of the horn section, and including the techniques.
He's the guy. He's the guy.
The guy.
He's the guy. We're playing it down, but we're in love with him. He's the guy.
No, yeah.
He's the guy.
But there's a lot. Go on.
I remember my dad sat me down and made me watch Motown 25 when I was younger. So I remember watching Michael Jackson come out and do Billie Jean and the moonwalk. And that was like the first time I think he'd done the moonwalk. I remember him playing me that when I was probably, because I was born around the time of this record. Sadly, I wish I was born later, obviously, as we all do. But so I think it was probably after about four or five when he first sat me down and played me that on like VHS. Yeah, and I remember watching that video. He had it in he used to get tapes and videos in like big box sets from it had like Motown embossed on the front. Like
yeah.
And I can remember and so that record and any Motown record basically. My dad was obsessed. So yeah, between that and then. Getting into it via horns, and then meeting two other guys that were also equally obsessed by the same horns. This was a match made in heaven.
I was going to say, like, you know, stuff, songs like this, like some of the songs on Thriller, from like a horn section point of view. You know, sometimes I'm listening, and my partner laughs at this all the time. She's like, "Is all you hear just horns?" Or when you listen to something, you know, like. Most people listen to maybe all of it, maybe the lyric. Like, I just hear it. You know, the horns are just like.
I think I speak for us all. We're all really bad at lyrics. Really bad. If someone says, "What's right. the even to the artist that we're working with?" If you ask us some of Paul's lyrics on the the hits of the songs, we'll be like, "Don't know." But horn part goes like this. even still now, you know.
And I'm kind of wondering because. When you compare this to, when you compare Thriller to his previous album, Off the Wall, I think Off the Wall has a lot more horns on it. So do you guys like that one more than Thriller?
I think all that stuff's just pretty equal, to be honest. But
right.
Yeah, it's all up there.
Yeah, I mean, and, it's better though, because there's more horns on it, isn't it? It's better, to be honest.
More is more. Like,
more is brilliant.
More is brilliant. I do think, though, that having less emphasis on horns with Thriller was a bit of a reaction to Off the Wall, because that record is very influenced by disco, and by the 80s, disco was completely out of fashion. So that might be why they're a bit less prominent on the record, but really, Thriller set the trends you would see throughout the 80s. It's still kind of in that in-between period where you still sort of had some 70s production techniques, but... At the same time, there's a lot of synth, there's a lot of drum machines, and it kind of brought that 80s sound to the mainstream, and everyone sort of had to follow it. Just one of the defining records of the 80s. It was produced by Quincy Jones, of course. And I think a big reason why it was so successful was that because it had a lot of genres on it, which made it sort of, it's something for everyone. And Michael really wanted it to be an album where every single song was a hit, because he was frustrated by albums where it would have one good song and then the rest were just, you know, throwaways. So, yeah. You know, Thriller, it is sort of, if you're trying to do that, it's probably one of the best albums to follow.
Well, yeah, because I was just looking and there's only 9 tracks on that album. So it sounds like you pretty much achieved what you set out to do.
Yeah.
Also, you mentioned the music video. That was a big, big pioneering thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The videos were interesting because, well, one, it was, of course, there was a bit of controversy at the time because there was this perceived notion that MTV wouldn't play videos by Black artists. Mm-hmm. And so once they started playing like the Billie Jean video and the Beat It video, that kind of paved the way for more Black artists to get recognition on MTV. And then the Thriller video, which is just so innovative because it was, you know, it was like a short film, basically. He brought in a guy named John Landis to direct it. And John directed Animal House and the Blues Brothers and a couple other big time movies. And that was the first time anyone had brought like a proper director to make a music video. And so it really turned the video into an art form, basically, which is quite interesting. What are your guys' favorite songs off of this album?
Oh,
I can read the track
list. I can tell you I really like PYT and Baby Be Mine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think Human Nature for me.
That Human Nature is probably my favorite Michael Jackson song, period, I think.
Really? Yeah. Well, wow. Just the way that the chords and the music works and just the whole,
I think Human Nature would be up there with mine, yeah.
The interesting thing with Human Nature was that it was written by a guy named Steve Percaro, who was in Toto.
Yeah.
And basically all of Toto plays on that song. Like it's Michael Jackson with Toto backing him up, which is kind of interesting. There were quite a few famous guests on this record. Of course, with Beat It, you had Eddie Van Halen playing the guitar solo.
Yeah.
And it's quite an interesting story because Eddie got the call to were asking him to do the song, Van Halen was on a break at that time and the other members of the band were on vacation, and they had a rule at that time where they didn't do stuff outside of the band, but
right.
Eddie couldn't get a hold of them because they were on vacation. So he just decided to do the record for free. That probably wasn't a great move on his part.
Terrible move.
Didn't make any money off of that song. And he also, it's also funny because he rearranged the song because during the guitar solo originally, it was just going to go bum, 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 bum the whole way through. But he had Quincy Jones change it so that it was like the verse chord progression to make it a bit more interesting. So yeah, he kind of that had a part in changing that one.
he's too involved if he's not getting paid. He's rewriting the song. This is crazy.
Yeah. He's missed out on a playing credit and a writing credit.
Yeah.
Can you imagine in this day and age trying, you know, he couldn't get hold of the band because they were on vacation. That'd be easy.
I know. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
We found and send them like, oh, can I play on Michael Jackson's record? No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to bring up The Girl Is Mine, which is, you know, fits in nicely with all our Paul talk today. Interestingly, I when I was doing my research, I found out that Say 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 and The Man, which are the other two songs that Paul and Michael did together, were worked on a year before The Girl Is Mine was recorded. But of course, The Girl Is Mine came out before those other two songs because they ended up on the Pipes of Peace album from Paul. And The Girl Is Mine is also the first single that was released off of Thriller. And it was very poorly received. And many people thought that the album would be a flop because of that song. But it still hit number 2 on the charts. And some people even viewed it as an example of racial equality by having Michael perform with a major star like Paul. Now, I've got to ask, because if you guys were on the road and Paul comes to the band and says, there's a special guest that's going to sing with us and they want to do The Girl Is Mine, who do you think would pull off Michael's part?
That's hard, isn't it?
That is hard, yeah. Because someone like Michael is such a unique artist, I think, you know, I'd feel... Kenji, you look like you've got a name on the tip of your tongue.
I think so.
Yeah, well...
I would have said someone like Brian McKnight, but it's not, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Could Usher do it?
Possibly.
I mean,
yeah.
I can't see Paul ringing Usher. I just don't know if... But you don't know, I don't know. I don't know. He seems to know everyone. He might ring him. I don't know.
What about Sam Smith?
Oh, okay.
Maybe.
Maybe.
If you could just organise for all of them to just hold some auditions, Jackson, that'd be fine.
I'll get in touch for sure. Yeah. Because I mean, I don't think they've that song has ever been performed live before. So,
Range-wise, Bruno Mars could hit those notes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Range-wise, Bruno Mars could hit those notes. I mean, I don't know. And I mean, people would want to see that, and that would cause quite a stir.
Yeah, it would.
Yeah.
But I don't know how Jackson's estate would feel about that. I don't know.
So I guess just to finish off here, what other Michael Jackson songs or albums that aren't Thriller that you guys like?
Off the Wall.
Burn This Disco
Out. Very much into.
I was going to say Burn This.
Yeah. I mean, all of Off the Wall, I'll take all of that. I'm into it. I'll lap it up. Love that.
Yeah.
Bad. Dangerous. I'm just naming Michael Jackson albums now, but I'm a fan, so.
I think from a horn section, you know, a horn point of view, Working Day and Night is really interesting because once you get into how that was, the horn part of that was created, it's fascinating, you know, the more you delve into that. So I think we all enjoyed that.
What's the one with the real quick? Is it Speed Demon?
Speed Demon.
That's another one that's got some quite interesting recording techniques and just some ferocious horn playing. Not that we only care about horns, but we kind of only care about horns.
Oh yeah, what's the lyric to that, Kent?
I will say lastly though, if we're talking about the horns. The one thing I have noticed on Thriller is that even though they're not as prominent as they are on like Off the Wall, I find they're so tasteful on Thriller. Mm. Like, you know, like on a song like Wanna Be Starting Something, you know, you got those like, ba-ba-ba-ba-da-da-da. Like it's just all like layered quite nicely. And it just, you know, it's not maybe not up front, but it just makes the song so much stronger. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It's really part of the sound, isn't it? As opposed to being, and I think that's that as a horn player, often you don't get a chance to be in something, if that makes sense. There's the rhythm section and you sit on top of it. But I feel like in some parts in Thriller, there's like, and also in like, yeah, is it, which one's Rock With You off? Because there's some really like
that's off that's the wall. That's off,
off the wall. There's some really nice parts in that where if you have to listen really closely, but it's sort of bedded in with, you know, flugelhorns and like, you know, it's not always, there's the punchy stuff, but there's also textural stuff that becomes part of the sound as opposed to being, which is why Jerry Hayes is brilliant.
We've reached the end of another episode. I want to thank the Hot City Horns, Paul Burton, Mike Davis, and Kenji Fenton for taking the time out of their busy schedule to appear on the podcast. It's such an honor to speak with such accomplished musicians, and you know, Paul McCartney is a hero of mine. So it's incredible to hear your experiences performing with him. So once again, thank you guys for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Jackson.
Yeah. And quickly, I also wanted to mention a shout out from my parents, because when I told them that I was going to be interviewing you guys, they were like, oh, they were like one of the best parts about that Paul McCartney show, so let them know that we think they're awesome.
That's lovely.
Thank you so much for tuning in to that amazing episode of Guess That Record. Feel free to check us out on social media. You can find us on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube, and we have the same username across all three platforms, at Guess That Record. You can also check out our website, www.guessthatrecordpodcast.com. Remember to keep rocking, and we'll see you on the next episode of Guess That Record.